Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
This is Yasa Sagonige, a 7th grade grandson of Sawanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee, head man of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evenings and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous, plant-based, native sacraments. Aho. Listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, for the present day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. Folks, the scriptures say my people perish for lack of knowledge. We live in a world that's becoming more and more dangerous as time goes by. Millions of people are aware of this fact now and are actively preparing. Back in 2004, the folks here at Prophecy Keepers Foundation foresaw this situation and began preparing information for you. Friends, I seriously suggest that you head over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look at the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library. The Prophecy Keepers Trilogy is a 1,000-page intelligence briefing. The trilogy is a sum total of many years of collecting, collating, analyzing, and comparing prophecies from all over the planet. Before he passed away in 1985, Mad Bear Anderson predicted that someone would do exactly what we have done. Mad Bear passed into spirit in 1985 before he could realize his dream of collecting and comparing prophecies from all over the world. He said in his biography, "Someday someone will collect all the native people's prophecies, myths, and legends and would publish them in one place so they could be compared with those of all native peoples worldwide, and then we really will have something." And friends, you'll be absolutely shocked to find out that we discovered exactly what that something was that Mad Bear wanted everyone to know. As it turns out, that certain special something that Mad Bear was searching for in the prophecies has everything to do with your physical safety and how to protect it. Now folks, there's absolutely nothing available on the planet like this collection. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. You'll also receive direct access to links that will allow you to download all 145 past Prophecy Keeper's interviews. Now folks, I won't kid you, Prophecy Keeper's does need money to continue to operate. We had a very close call at the end of last month. We almost didn't raise the funds that we needed to stay here on Blog Talk Radio. So please head on over to prophecykeepers.info and take a look. OCO, Ginalee, this is Blue Otter coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the Cherokee Nation. Well, hi, everybody. It's Blue Otter. coming to you from my undisclosed location somewhere deep in the backwoods of East Central Tennessee. And we've got my co-host Mark on board.
How's it go?
His mic is live, and Kimberly's mic is live. Say hello, Kimberly.
Hello. How's everybody? Hi.
Doing fine. What, yes, go ahead and introduce yourself, and we just kind of run the show by the spirit, and we'll do a song by every.
Tell my story? That sounds great.
Yeah,
well,
just dive right into it.
My name is Kimberly Ruff. I'm an MFT, which is a marriage family therapist, and that's my job, but the reason I'm on the radio show is I have been asked to be the messenger of the Hopi Tibet prophecy, and I want to start off by explaining that I am not a Hopi prophecy carrier, and I am not a Tibetan prophecy carrier. I'm a messenger of this third and completely separate prophecy called the Hopi Tibet prophecy. That to be a Hopi prophecy carrier, we have to be Hopi, and even then, only certain people. And the Hopi are very, very, very sensitive about their prophecy being out into the world. And so I want to just make it super clear that I am not a Hopi prophecy carrier. And then to be a Tibetan prophecy carrier, you sort of have to be someone who actually was there with Padme Sambhava, the Tibetan prophet. And so the information I've gotten has been from people who are reincarnations of the either Padme Sambhava or the disciples of Padme Sambhava. I am the messenger of the Hopi Tibet prophecy, which is the connection. It's a prophecy that was created out of the connection between these two prophecies. That the Hopi prophecy, I mean, I have permission to tell a little bit the part that, you know, has to do with both of them. The Hopi prophecy is a very, very long prophecy that takes 8 to 9 days to tell. And it begins when the Iron Eagle flies and the horses run on wheels, and then it, you know, goes on and on. And in this prophecy, it does speak about men with red hats coming, you know, to help the Hopi in this, when this time becomes very difficult for them. Well, and that prophecy is very, very old. In the 7th century, Padme Sambhava gave many prophecies. And the Tibetans have many short prophecies. Like I say, the Hopi have that one long. But the Tibetans have a prophecy that is very short, and it matches. And it says, when the Iron Eagle flies in the sky and stone bridges cover rivers, horses with wheels will run on roads. East will meet west, red people will meet red people. At that time, my teachings will benefit the world, Padme Sambhava. And so the Hopi Tibet prophecy is this very specific prophecy that was created out of these two prophecies joining. And the first activation of the Hopi Tibet prophecy was in 1974, the very first Tibetan came to Hopi. It was His Holiness the 16th Karmapa. And he came to Hopi, you know, as a realization of his prophecy, and he was told by the Tibetan oracle, go to Hopi. So then the second realization of this Hopi Tibet prophecy specifically is that the Tibetan life has come to the West. And this is indicated by the Dharma centers that are now here in the West, and also the coming of the reincarnations and the Tibetan lamas and tulkus being born here in the West instead of Tibet, like they always were before. And then the third activation is this whole other thing, which is in the works right now, so I'm not really at liberty to speak of. But that is what the Hopi Tibet prophecy is. So I wanted to just start off to make really, really clear that I am not a Hopi prophecy carrier or Tibetan prophecy carrier. I'm the messenger of this amazing prophecy of hope that was created out of where these two prophecies join. And all of these things were supposed to happen before December 21st, 2012. And if these causes and conditions were created, then we would begin what is called the time of never-ending peace. And from what I've been told, everything is going exactly like it's supposed to. And that's why I've been asked to speak about this, because there's so much doom and gloom and fear prophecies out there right now. And there really aren't that many people talking about this other option. And so specifically, some of the Hopi and some of the Tibetans have asked me to come forward with this, and that's why I'm doing this radio show. So, yeah, that's a description of what the Hopi Tibet prophecy is. Did you have any questions about that?
Kimberly, you know what, when it was that 16th Karmapa, it was in 1974, you know what day it was on?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I could certainly find out. I am friends with a man that drove His Holiness the Karmapa, this guy named Steve Ross. He was like the chauffeur. He brought His Holiness. So I can look that up because I'm friends with him. In fact, in 2008, His Holiness the 16th Karmapa died and passed away. And then the 17th Karmapa was reincarnated. And he recently came to the United States. He had his first visit in 2008. And so Steve Ross went to see him. And contacted me about coming out to Hopi and getting a letter from the Hopi to invite the 17th Karmapa to Hopi. And we were able to do that. And in fact, we were able to give him a rattle. And Steve Ross took the rattle to His Holiness the 17th Karmapa. So as far as the day, that's a great question, but I will check on it. I'll make a little.
Well, the reason I was asking, because I was curious what day in the Hopi ceremonial cycle, where in their ceremonial cycle that happened.
That's
and
a
if
really
I remember
good
right,
question.
One
yeah.
of those, I don't know if it's him, one of them did a, one of the Tibetans came into Hopi and did a prayer and different things, mantra and stuff, and got some rain, and that really, if I remember right, that
yeah.
really impressed the Hopi that they got the rain.
Oh, yeah, that was the 16th Karmapa. He came and made it rain. Yeah, the 16th Karmapa had very, 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 very many gifts, and yes, it was an amazing thing. So would you like for me to begin explaining how I became the messenger, or did you want to ask me more questions?
Well, whatever you want.
Okay.
Your show.
Oh, sure. No, I wasn't quite sure. So it was Blue Eye. Are you there? Were you asking some questions? Do you want me to continue? Is he still there? Is he gone?
Yeah, just
Hello?
Go ahead.
Okay. No,
Like you said, how did you get started with this in
okay.
terms of messenger?
Oh, sure. What happened was...
I apologize. That was off mic for a minute, so I apologize.
Oh, yeah. I didn't want to continue. I didn't know. I didn't know how you ran your show. I didn't
want
to change subjects.
I did want to say that, the Tibetans got together with the Hopi in L.A., a while back, and they spent so much time partying they didn't get done what they were supposed to get done. And there
yes,
has
I do. I have
been,
heard about this.
There has been another secret meeting recently, that's all I know.
Oh yes. Yes. I have a photo of that. Grandfather Martin Goshwe-Siome has been asking me to help bring His Holiness the Dalai Lama back to Hopi, for many, many years, because that is exactly what he told me, was that they weren't able to discuss their secrets in the way that he had hoped. And so, we've been in the process of putting together all kinds of meetings, and, there have been a lot of wonderful meetings, a lot of Tibetans since that time. So so would you like for me to explain a little bit about how I became the messenger?
Go right ahead.
Okay. In 2001, I was married and had these two little boys, and I had no idea what was happening, but I got a phone call to come downtown and was told that these Tibetan monks were going to be in Santa Barbara, where I live, and that they wanted me to come and bring my son, that someone had this information that they were looking for this reincarnation of one of their Tibetan lamas. Well, back in 2001, I didn't have any idea anything about Tibet. I didn't know anything about reincarnation. I was completely baffled, but I thought it would be nice to go down and see them. They're making this beautiful Samandala. And this was in August of 2001, and these monks were telling me that my son was this reincarnation of one of their Tibetan lamas. At this time, I didn't even know what, you know, like where Tibet was or anything. I had no idea what was going on. So in the beginning, I kind of didn't even really believe them. And then in September, some more Tibetan lamas came, and they brought a Tibetan astrologer, and they said, you know, based on his birthday and et cetera, that he was a reincarnation. And more and more monks, Tibetan monks, came from various monasteries. And then in December of 2000, when I was asked to bring my son to specifically meet with a venerable Bhakatuka Rinpoche, and he, apparently the way this works is, in Tibet, when they have Tibetan lamas or tulkus, they say where they're going to be born. That's like their tradition, that they leave clues and information, and like with the very high ones, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama or the Panchen Lama or something like this, they literally leave like a road map. I since was told about a movie called Little Buddha, which was a beautiful feature film that was based on one of the very first reincarnations that came to the West. So anyway, I was asked to bring my son to meet with this Venerable Bhakatuka Rinpoche, and I didn't even know, like, what to do, like, where to start or anything. So I went over there, and I said, well, excuse me, you know, do you think that my son is this tulku? And he said, you know, yes. Well, I still didn't understand really what's happening, but it turns out that only certain Tibetan Rinpoches can sort of sponsor someone to claim that they are a reincarnation, and then ultimately it's up to His Holiness the Dalai Lama to approve of this or authorize this. It turned out that in 1959, when China took over Tibet, that the Tulkus no longer wanted to be born in Tibet because it was no longer safe. So they chose to get born in the West. And they're saying that my son was one of these Tulkus and that he had literally been an old lama in 1959 and had been with a group that had crossed over the Himalayas in 1959. And he'd been an old lama. And he had died on this trip. And so what Tibetans do then is they send out a search party, and that the people that first came looking for my son had been there in 1959. The first group had was the Gume Tibetan monks, and there was a venerable Dawa who had been only 2 years old in 1959. He'd traveled across the Himalayas with his family. And then this other one came later that was Venerable Tashi, and he crossed over with his family also. Excuse me. And so anyway, how this came to be was, so in December of 2001, you know, this Venerable Bhakatuka Rinpoche told me that, yes, your son is a tulku. Well, I had no idea what to do with this information or you know, anything. At that time, Bhakatuka Rinpoche gave my son this rock with some ancient writing, And I had no idea what any of this meant. I remember at the time him handing me this rock and, you know, he like smiled and turned it upside down. I mean, I didn't even, it turned to be Sanskrit. I didn't even know what Sanskrit looked like. So then the next month, it was January 2002, this woman came to me and she said, I have come representing the Hopi, and we were wondering if any of the Tibetans gave your son a rock with ancient writing. And they did. And so I gave it to her, and she said, we would like for you to come with us to Hopi and bring this rock with us, which just seemed completely out of the question. I had never left my children. I had two boys. I hadn't traveled. I'd just been working as an MFT and, you know, being a mom. But she asked me to go, and she said it was very, very, very important. And so I did actually go with her, and I brought this rock, and it was this amazing, amazing experience, because I had no idea when we got there what was even going to happen. And when we were on the road and we first arrived at Hopi, this woman then says to me, you tell me where to go. And I said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And she said, well, you're supposed to know where to go. I said, well, I have these dreams about this man, you know, and we meet at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. And she says, well, how do we find him? And I said, well, we find him by going into this store. And so we went into this, we only have one store in the town of Hope Villa where we're going. And this woman said, may I help you? And I said, we're looking for this man. And I described him, and she said, oh, you're probably looking for Grandfather Martin Gautry Sioma. He is the keeper of the sacred tablets of the Fire Clan. I will take you there. And we had to get there really in a few minutes, because it was, you know, the sun was setting. You can't go after sundown. And for whatever reason, the rock had to be delivered that night, because the next morning was the Pwamu. And it specifically was supposed to get there before that particular Pwamu. So this woman took us to this home, and it was this moment that changed my life.
Hey, you said you want to take a break every once in a while because of your voice.
Uh-huh.
And so that sounds like a good time to take a break. So just rest for about 5 minutes, and we'll be back.
That sounds great.
Which warns, when the gourd of ashes drops, you will know the end of the world is near. The Hopi elders believed the atom bomb to be that very gourd of ashes, for in 1948 they held a tribunal, appointing a guardian of their prophecies. Prophecies set in stone by distant ancestors and covered with the dust of time. The man chosen? Thomas Banyanka.
He's been here for a long time. They knew about its destroying, but no one knew it was here.
Thomas Banyanka is the keeper of the carvings. It was he who uncovered the prophecies etched in stone after they lay hidden for many years.
So I wrapped this. So I was the one that cleaned this mess up and saw the drawing. And I was so surprised.
Thomas Banyanka is one of several Hopi elders who is entrusted with the pre-Columbian prophecy that has a series of final warnings to be told to the world before what is called the Great Purification by Fire. Either it can be a fire of nuclear war and greenhouse global warming, or it can be a fire of inner consciousness.
In the Four Corners region of Arizona, the ancient Hopi prophecy rock looms, chronicling the destiny of mankind in Hopi hieroglyphics, leading towards what some fear is inevitable extinction.
This figure represents the great spirit or guardian of this land that we came on this earth, what we call now the Mother Earth.
In the first figure carved by the Hopi ancients, the great spirit or creator meets man. The Creator then gave man the sacred circle, a promised life of peace and plenty if, and only if, man would follow the spiritual path. While the brown man waited, The white man traveled the earth on a mission to spread the spiritual circle and return with knowledge.
He was supposed to bring this, but instead he brought a symbol of a cross, they said. It's on here, cross.
Breaking away from the Native American people, the white man now traveled the path of materialism and invention, as shown by these three figures on the Rock of Prophecy.
I always say that first figure represents the first invention, like wagon, pulled by animals. And later, the second one, representing advancements in inventions, he brought automobiles that run by itself. Then the third one represents also advancements in inventions, scientific things, and now they have rode up in the sky.
With the invention of the aeroplane, the white man now commanded the land, sea, and sky. And just as the Hopi prophecy rock appears to predict, this thirst for power led to two devastating events, World War I and World War II.
There's a mine down over here, and that's where we are today. And the zigzag light represents up there big nations, powerful nations, put the military might together and kill thousands of women, children, animals, birds. We have now come into last little circle above the line, which is, they said, maybe the beginning of Third World War.
And so, as the Hopi prophecy goes, we find ourselves at the crossroads with the fate of the entire race of man hanging on one all-important question. Do we return to the sacred circle and the life of harmony and abundance? Or do we take the jagged road, leading us further and further from the spiritual path?
If that...
So, which way do we go, Kimberly?
Well, actually, I would love to comment on that piece that you're, you know, playing, and then I'll go back to my story, because Grandfather Thomas Banyaka, that's who they're interviewing, he was the man that discovered the prophecy rock, and one of the elders I studied with was the apprentice of Grandfather Thomas Banyaka, and she told me that Grandfather Thomas passed away before he knew how this was going to turn out. But, you know, he died, I think, in 1999. And it was right around then that everything began to change. It was about, you know, 10 or so years ago that, you know, the Hopi prophecy talks about the two paths, the path of the one heart and the path of the two heart. And the one heart, everything works out the path of the two heart, just global annihilation and nuclear wars, et cetera. And this woman has been very, very adamant that we have crossed into the path of the one heart. And, you know, this is a controversial issue because, you know, really truly for a Hopi to say, but she has told me and asked me to put out to the world that we have entered into the fifth world. We have entered into the time of the one heart, and that Grandfather Thomas would have been thrilled to have lived long enough to see this, because I've seen that video that you're just playing, and at the end of it, from what I remember, he sort of says it's not looking good for Earth, and it wasn't up until 10 years ago, and truly, 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 right around 10 years ago is when everybody on Earth sort of stepped up to what they were came to do. But anyways, I'd like to get back to the story about this, how I became this messenger. So where I left off was I had this rock with Tibetan writing, and I brought it to this man. And when they opened the door, I was so happy. I remember his face. And apparently, he remembered me also. And so I brought him this rock, and we talked, and this was the beginning of this intense friendship. And I've since been adopted into the Hopi family of Grandfather Martin Gashi Siam. I want to also make really clear that you can't really be adopted into the Hopi tribe. You're sort of adopted into a family. I also want to make really, really clear that there is a whole other Hopi prophecy about the tablet and the missing piece of the tablet. And I've been asked, you know, do you think this rock that your son brought is the missing piece of the tablet? So I want to make very, very clear that no, it is not. It doesn't look like it. It's not shaped like it or anything. I have been told that it is symbolic of the missing piece of the tablet. And the reason is what was written on this rock that we brought was in Sanskrit. It said, Om Mani Padme Hum. And this, in those words, in those six syllables, it contains all of the compassion in the Buddha's 84,000 teachings. And what I have been told that this whole connection between the Hopi and Tibetan prophecy is that the Hopi believe that they are the center of the universe, and that what happens at Hopi affects the world, and that in the last, you know, 100 years or so, it hasn't been very, you know, good out there. There's been a lot of infighting and conflict that began, you know, with the founding of Hope Villa and all of this. And so when they talk about this time when the Hopi are in trouble, this is what, from what I've been told, they're speaking of. And that what is missing is compassion. And that the Hopi, who used to be known as the peaceful people, lost touch with their compassion. And so that's why the Tibetans came, was to bring the compassion. And that's why there's a whole third prophecy that says if these things actually occur and they meet and, you know, they exchange their, you know, who they are, then it will create this kind of never-ending peace. And so that is where I was asked to speak, because in on 080808, Grandfather Martin asked me to go public for him. I really, really, really did not want to. From 020202 when I met him to 080808 when he asked me, I met him, you know, I visited many, many times. During that time, I also became extremely familiar with Tibetan Buddhism and, you know, taken vows and et cetera. And I have been told that my adorable son is literally the human link linking these two cultures. And I was asked by grandfather to share this with the world. He said very specifically, he was losing his hearing. He was getting very old. And he said, I am going to retire, and I'm asking you to take this to the world for me, because it's very important that the message gets out there about the Hopi Tibet prophecy before December 21st, 2012. People need to know. Otherwise, they're just going to be frightened. I didn't want to do it. I had no idea. I didn't even know where to start. And he told me to write on the internet. Well, I didn't have any experience writing on the internet at all. I've been a therapist, and I don't have any writing background, and I didn't even know how to get started. And he said, I will send you a dream, and, you know, I'll work that side out for you. And so sure enough, I had this dream that this woman came to me and said, I am from the ground crew. And so in real life, I woke up and I Googled the ground crew. And indeed, this woman who was in the dream was there. And she has this website. She's this lovely woman named Valerie Donner. And she asked if I wanted to write a column on her website. So that's how this started. Grandfather Martin told me that there is a second prophecy rock. Have you been out the letter two, you know, the Hopi prophecy rock in Hopi?
I had a very short window to visit him, and the weather was getting bad, so I didn't get a chance to go out. But
Well, because the reason I'm asking is there's this beautiful, famous, you know, Hopi prophecy rock, but there's this little rock off to the right. It is kind of known as, you know, the second Hopi prophecy rock, but it's not, of course, as famous, and most people don't even know what it is. A lot of people in Sedona think it's a spaceship, but Grandfather Martin told me very, very clearly, and others have also, that it's an instrument, and it looks like a satellite. If you want to go to the website, www.thegroundcrew.com, this is where I've been posting. I've been writing this, and there's pictures of this. But specifically, Grandfather Martin told me that the second prophecy rock said there would be a time when this instrument would make it possible for everyone in the world to communicate. And it didn't matter what language they spoke, that they would be able to communicate and share this. And he said that this was how we were going to be able to pull off moving into the fifth world, which kind of makes sense now that with the Internet, people have been able to communicate. And with the Internet, I've been able to write these postings. I've written about 28 now since 08, 08, 08. And since that time, oh, and also I want to make really, really, really clear, this is so important, I'm not making any money from any of this. It's really important because
hey, we're putting out money to do this.
Yes.
Always
yes.
Have.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Because Massa the Creator says that you cannot sell the Hopi prophecy, that it would be like selling your mother. So I just want to make it really clear that anything I do, I don't get a penny. So I just want to make that super clear. The reason I'm bringing that up is after I wrote like a bunch of these postings, I was asked to write in this book. And this is another situation where I haven't gone looking for any of this. In fact, the whole thing's been sort of intimidating for me, but I've been going for it because it's such an important cause, especially at this time in history. So I know the Hopi, the Tibetans came looking for me, the Hopi came looking for me. Then I started writing these postings, and then these people asked me to write in this book. It's called Transforming Through 2012, and it was a book that was about 33 authors who had things to say about the hopeful, optimistic outcome of 2012. It was written, you know, of course, before 2012, because so many people were frightened about what was happening. So I was asked to write a little something, and then that is how I ended up doing these radio shows. That's how these got started, was, you know, they wanted me to go out and talk about this book. And then that has led to just all kinds of other things. So that is how I became this messenger, was because I was asked to. And, yeah, I haven't made a penny from this. Like I say, I have to cover my own costs when I travel, et cetera. But my heart is completely in all of this. And so I feel this so strongly. There are all these things that I'm supposed to do, you know, and help assist that they get done before December 21st, 2012. And that's why the fact that, I mean, it's, you know, we're here. We're in 2012. It just blows me away. And that's why I'm doing, you know, so many radio shows and all kinds of other things. Because I have been actually told about this from the time when I was a little tiny girl. And so that's why when I was asked to do this, I was shocked, but I was also not shocked. When I was a small child, these light beings came to me and told me ahead of time that this is all potentially going to happen. And you know, they're telling me this Hopi prophecy that there are two paths, and they can go this way, go that way. And, yeah, so that's what that's how I became this messenger. So do you have any questions or anything about that?
No, you want to take another short break?
Sure, I'll give my throat a little second to breathe.
Okay,
that'd be great.
You bet. Let's see, here's a good one from Floyd Red Crow Westerman. How long have you been blind?
Huh. countryside. You can't sweep it under the rug. You got trouble you can't hide. Trouble on a reservation, trouble in the ghetto too. And the lies you told my children are coming down on you. How long have you been blind? Been coming a long, long time. You got no place to retreat. Trouble in your courtroom, trouble written on the wall. In all the pieces of your mistakes are starting to fall. How long have you been blind? Been coming a long, long time. But they got no place to go. But there's a red man in the mountains, dancing in the snow. Time will be a season, I know it'll come to pass. But those who listen to the sign will be those to the last. How long have you been blind? Been coming a long, long time. The way you live, you've been taking for so long. You don't know how to give. How long have you been blind? Been coming a long, long time.
And we're back. I don't know if anybody else is back, but I'm here.
Yep, I'm here.
Hey, did you guys know that I used to be a singer?
No, really?
Yeah, the next break I'll play you my version of City of New Orleans.
Oh, that sounds like a good thing. I would love
unless
to
hear unless
that.
You want me to play it right now. No, just kidding. I'll play it later. I'm really
so
proud
Mark,
of it because go ahead.
Oh, he was gonna say Mark was gonna ask a question.
Oh, yeah. What did these light beings that appeared to you and visited you when you were a little child, what did they look like?
Well, I can say, I'm so glad that you asked that question, Mark, because I wasn't really supposed to talk about them until the year 2012. So this is extremely exciting for me to be talking about this publicly. I was born in 1958 in Arkansas, in Cherokee Country. I'm a fourth Cherokee. I'm actually 3/8. My dad's a half and my mom's a fourth. But I just say a fourth instead of 3/8. But anyway.
Did that
so I was born.
Wait, now we're getting to the root. Are you aware that the anciently the Hopi and the Cherokee were considered to be the twin fires?
No. Oh, I'd love to read about Dr. that. Tim, you have like something on that you can send me or something?
Yeah, Dr. Tim Jones is a mixed blood Cherokee. He is the father of the of an actual school of archaeology known as the Trash Pile School. Last time I heard, he was on faculty out at University of Arizona. But he has twin doctorates in archaeology and ethnology, and he's a White House Fellow, National Science Foundation scholar, and according to him, you know, anciently, there used to be grand councils. Like Indians used to, convene from all over North America at Hot Springs, Arkansas, in Monataca. And if you know, there's a lot of people, you know, in a lodge, but if a Hopi or a Cherokee even looked like they were going to speak, everybody shut up and listened.
Really?
So that's what's going on. Yeah, really.
Oh no, that's one.
People laugh at Cherokees, a lot of the particularly Plains Indians. They laugh at Cherokees. They don't know.
Well, that's part of why I have these dreams I was talking about, because my father dreamed. He was one that was, you know, half Cherokee. He was grown up on a farm in Arkansas, and he used to have these dreams, and he saw auras and whatever, and I inherited from his side of the family. I'm what I've been told is a Cherokee dreamwalker, and so all my life I've had these dreams every single morning of my life. And since
was he a rough?
My dad's name was Ruff, yeah, Danny.
Okay.
Ruff, Danny Gene Ruff, Harrison.
Where in Arkansas?
He was born in Western Grove, and my relatives, you know, the Ruffs, all live there. And since now there's Facebook, you know, like I'm in touch with my relatives. It's like,
because Howard Ruff is a friend of mine, and I used to work for his son-in-law, you know, How to Prosper During the Bad Years.
Yeah, I'm
Ruff,
not sure if he's better. A relative. I'd sure like it if he was.
Howard knows he's a Cherokee.
Oh, maybe we are related, because,
yeah,
you know, we're from that area.
What county in Arkansas? Tell me the name of the town again, because...
I was born in Van Buren, Arkansas, and I was born in the county of Van Buren, Arkansas. But my dad was from Western Grove, and my mom is from... Where is she from? She's from Harrison? I'm not actually sure. But, yeah, they're both Cherokee. Because, you know, in that area,
Harrison is right outside, I think it was the place where the agency was for the 1817 Cherokee Reservation. One of my teachers was Grandfather Richard Craker, and he was the Ottawahee for the White River Band. And you may have heard that White River Band. That's Chickamauga Cherokees. And my second wife, who passed away, that's her people. Well, another thing Tim Jones taught, that he said he proved scientifically, because he had access to all the archaeological digs that were cataloged and then destroyed later. But he proved scientifically 800 years that northwestern Arkansas was the place where the Cherokees landed whenever they migrated back and forth from Mexico. And he says if he had time and money, he could prove it back 1,600 years. But he said he discerned this because of the design of the Cherokee ball courts.
Oh, interesting.
So,
now,
yeah.
I don't know that much. I really don't know as much about my Cherokee lineage as my adopted Hopi lineage. But, both sides of my family, so, like, all my relatives are Cherokee, which, you know, it's very, very primary to who I am. And, you know, my dad was very proud of the fact that I went forward with this, because he grew up in a time when you tried to pass as white. You know, you couldn't own land, and so it meant a lot to him that I was always very proud of my ethnicity.
I couldn't find Western Grove on a map. Do you know what town that might have been?
It's just
near
a little farm area. I mean, like I say, he grew up in this, you know. I can ask my mom later.
Yeah, it's right smack in the middle of the 1817 reservation. Yeah.
Oh,
yes, it was called,
my mom's
Lovely's Purchase.
Oh,
and Harrison,
my mom's mom
was like 5 miles outside of and just south of the old reservation. See,
yeah, that's where my mom's mom was born, is that reservation you're referring to.
Uh-huh.
Like I said, my dad is a half. My mom
what was
born,
your mother's mother's last name?
Her name was Morningstar, Aurelia Morningstar. Oh, I've got all this stuff written down.
I'll give you a phone number of Grandfather Craker. He had a secret book of surnames.
Oh.
And In 2001, at Kabul, Missouri, when I was living there, we had about 60 people come for a stomp dance. He spent the first 2 hours just asking people, what was your mother's, you know, as far back as you can remember. And he assigned people into clans. Because you can't do a stuff, but yeah, you need to know, you know, who your clan is. And
reason I know some of their names is my older son, it was, you know, going off to college, and I was hoping that we could get on the Cherokee, you know, rolls, the Dawes rolls, and get some like scholarships or something. But it turned out that the John Bynum that I'm related to is another same John Bynum that was on the rolls, and then somebody told me that John Bynum was white anyway, which I don't even understand.
What's going on here is there has been a war going on inside the Cherokee Nation between the traditionals that left. You see, the 1817 reservation was made up of old settlers. These were people who had a traditional government, and they left the East. They left the whited hang around the Fort Cherokees back in North Carolina, and starting in 1740, there was a group that Dangerous Man let out. 1790s, the Chickamaugas moved into Arkansas, and later a lot of them moved into Texas. But, they're going to tell you, oh, yeah, they were white and all this other kind of stuff. That's just bull. You know, they were old settlers.
Yeah, and I didn't understand what they were talking about.
The reason why they're not on the rolls is because you had to have walked the Trail of Tears and signed the register at Tahlequah to be on the Dawes rolls. Otherwise, and then there was John Watts, who was the successor of the Chickamauga chief that was, or the Texas Cherokee chief that was killed in Texas, leader of the Texas Cherokees. A few of them did get on the rolls, but there was according to the John Hoag's or Tim Hoag's book, there was a conspiracy between Chief Joel Mays and Will Rogers' father to kick them off the rolls.
Really?
So yeah, we're the real Cherokees. You know, we're not yet conquered, but yeah, and they'll tell you all kinds of nasty stuff, and they were white men. Just ignore it.
Well, I don't understand the topic. I mean, both sides of my family are Cherokee. You know, we all know this. I was just hoping we could get like a card to help my son get into college. But the good news is he got into a really great college anyway. So I'm so happy because, I never did get that rolls thing figured out. But to go back to the Hopi Tibet prophecy.
Hold on just a second.
Sure.
Well, this Cherokee connection thing with her, do you think, and you mentioned Texas and stuff, do you think this has may connect into the Cherokee in Mexico?
Well, yeah, that's where we all came from. The least
okay.
My 11th great grandfather was the first beloved man of the Cherokees. That's back before they called them principal chiefs.
Oh, so you're like family.
And he was the custodian of the Cherokee sacred ark.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's so great. Wonderful.
And his grandson Gardner Green was on the 1835 Henderson immigration rolls.
Huh. That's great.
Well, reason I was asking is because I think there's some kind of connection here with the Cherokee down in Mexico with the Mayan and the Hopis on their migrations in Maya land. And there's something going on there is the reason I'm asking.
Well, you can just go to CherokeeDiscovery.com, click on history, and you'll see actual archaeological evidence that we lived alongside the Maya.
Oh,
right.
That's so good.
And,
no, definitely.
And as far as, you know, Elizabeth Warren, people were making a big stink about Elizabeth Warren claiming to be Cherokee, and a lot of really hate, you know, going toward her. And I posted about 200 different places that it's a matter of history that in 1540, Hernan de Soto traveled through south central Tennessee, and he saw red-haired, green-eyed, and blonde-haired, blue-eyed Cherokee children running the streets. So we've been multicultural, you know, for a long time. So
I know that that's true because my dad has, you know, he passed away, but he had one green eye and one blue eye, like a dog or a cat has. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but he had the jet black hair. In fact, I was actually born with jet black hair just like him, but then it, like, fell out and came in darker, and well, then I started dyeing it.
Oh, yeah.
But I remember my mom saying...
Chickamauga chiefs were red-haired.
Yes. Yeah, oh, no, I was actually born with black hair, but I remember her telling me that the Cherokees were very light. But I want to get back to Mark's question before I lose track.
You bet.
Mark was asking me about the lights, and, you know, I was telling the story about how I became this messenger and how, on one level, the whole thing has just been overwhelming, but yet amazingly wonderful, and that I've been so shocked. But on another level, like, not, because what happened was, so I was born in Arkansas, Cherokee land, from 1958 to 1960. And then from 1960 to 1966, we lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico. My parents moved there. During that time, I spent most of my time out on the mesas talking to these lights. And I remember them. I mean, I never forgot them. It's they've stayed with me my whole life as far as the memory of them. They left in 1966. So what happened is there was a red light and a green light and a yellow light, and I would just sit on the mesas with the tumbleweeds and the horny toads going by, and they would talk to me. And I remember very, very clearly what they were saying. And
let me ask you something. Were they little tiny little lights, or were they, did they look like ships?
No.
They were really just round lights, like you see in the sky, like the Pleiades has like a blue light. It was like that.
Yeah, but they're the size of a grapefruit, a baseball, a dime, a nickel, or, you know, how big were they?
Well, let me ask you something. Let's listen to something briefly here. You tell me if this is what this is. Robbie Robertson's song, The Lights.
Oh, isn't he like Mohawk or something?
Yeah, listen to this.
Okay. Because I will look into that song. So anyway, these lights, they told me, you are a scout. And they told me that they were from, you know, like the Pleiades, which is where the Cherokees sort of say they're, you know, from.
Yep.
And they said that I was from there too, and that I had come down, I'd volunteered to come down as a scout, and that I was to send transmissions to them, because they told me, this was back in 1960, that they were going to attempt this grand experiment on Earth, and that there were other scouts on Earth, like me, other places, and that they needed information as to whether or not this planet was somewhere that they could try this, this grand experiment. And I would just talk and talk to these lights all the time, and my, you know, mother and brother, like, drove them crazy. So my mother took me to the psychiatrist to find out if I was insane, and they said no. They did all kinds of tests and said she's just extremely creative. If these lights don't go away by the time she's older, we'll have to, like, you know, whatever. So then they did go away. But here's the coolest thing, Blair. When my son was this little person that turned out to be, you know, a tuku, when he was the age I was when I saw these lights, I was rocking him one time, and I said, you know, Joe, when I was your age, I used to have friends that were lights. And my son said to me, I know, I was the green light. My brother was the yellow light, and the red one was our sister, and she did not come. And it blew me away because supposedly, you know, like I had been born in 1958, and these lights had come in 1960. 1959, the year before that, was the year my son died. You know, this was the year that they escaped Tibet, you know, the occupation of Tibet. And so it just blew me away to think, wow, you know, we must be on the path to pulling this off. And this was like 10 years ago when this all began to happen, because it was just a, you know, a few months later that the Tibetans started showing up, and this is how it all happened. But what was so interesting, you know, Mark, because you're asking about these lights, is I remember what they said. They said, you know, here are instructions for if we're going to try and pull this off. And then they very specifically said, do not speak of this, about the lights, until 2012, that if we make it, go for it. And so that's what's so interesting. The day it turned January 1st, 2012, I began speaking publicly. I'd already been doing these radio shows about the lights, because what they had said was all of the universe has tried this before, and they haven't succeeded. And what I've been told, you know, because I've talked to elders, you know, in the last 10 years, and what they've told me is that we have succeeded in pulling something off on this planet that has never been done before, and that we indeed have been successful. And so, you know, the Hopi call it coming into the fifth world, the Tibetans call it coming to Shambhala. And so even though it looks so scary out there with, you know, economic collapse and whatever, everything I've been told by all these people that are asking me to talk about it have said, we have indeed completed this compassion grid and created the causes and conditions to shift into this next world. And, you know, so that's the part I wanted to share with Mark about the lights, is that, that's the lights told me. And what's also interesting is the yellow and green and red lights left, but other colors came in their place. And since I gave birth to my son, blue and lavender and other colored lights have you know, come and continue to talk. So I also want to talk some more about the Hopi Tibetan prophecy a little bit more. Did you have any questions about any of the stuff I was just saying?
I'm good.
Okay. Then I'll just continue. Because there's a couple things I for sure wanted to cover. And one of them is how this woman that came from the Hopi found me. Because the Tibetans, you know, they weren't looking really for me. They're looking for my son. You know, and they have this way that, have you seen Little Buddha, that movie about how, you know, they
sure.
Well, yeah, and then Kundun, and, you know, they set out looking for the, but the Hopi was a whole other story. This woman told me that there had been a vision quest to find the woman with this rock, and that Chief Archie Langdeer had said, I know who this woman is. They had all had this vision together of this woman on this bus banging on the door, this blonde woman with bangs, banging on the door, let me out of here. But Chief Langdeer said, I know who that woman is. Well, here's the wacky part. In 1986 or 7, I don't remember which year it was, it was when there was a full moon and a summer solstice on the same night. My sister was visiting, you know, who's also Cherokee, and we went up to this sweat lodge with my Chumash friend Brenda that Chief Archie Langdeer was leading, and he's this, you know, famous, wonderful Lakota chief. He's since passed away. And I had never been to a sweat lodge, and it was dark, and when they put the little flap over and it was all dark, I just completely panicked, and I started screaming, let me out of here. And, I mean, you're not supposed to do that in a sweat. You're really not. But I just freaked. And so I pushed aside, and I just went running into the woods, and so Chief Langdeer went running after me and asked his son to complete the sweat. So I was just running away and just crying. And then finally I stopped, and he said, and this guy was like 6'4". He's enormous. And he says to me, what are you running from? And I just said, I don't know. And he said, you can't run from your destiny forever. And I thought, what is he talking about? But then I thought, I don't want to know what he's talking about. And so, you know, when this woman came saying, you know, because he knew the person invited us, and that's how he knew what, that's how they find me. And so it's so interesting because it's like all this was designed like before. And so even though I resisted it and tried to run away from it, it sort of found me. And as a result of this, good stuff has happened. Like I say, I really feel like the things, like I say, that let me talk about, that we're still doing to help activate the third activation of the Hopi Duke prophecy, I feel tremendous joy knowing that we're doing what we signed up to do. People have asked me, how would you describe the year 2012? And I tell them, I would call it the year of remembering, because that's all it feels like I'm doing, is remembering what the lights told me, what I signed up for. But here's the thing, Blue Water, from what I've been told, everybody here signed up. Everybody on Earth right now signed up. Everyone here came for some reason, but not everybody remembers why they're here. And so that is what now is. And I've had people ask me, well, what do I do to remember? And so I tell them, ask for a dream, do a meditation, but just please don't ask anyone else what your purpose is. Only you know what your purpose is. And so that's very much what, you know, I am trying to help spread the message, is I believe everyone on Earth right now has potential to help with this ascension that we've already sort of kick-started.
Do you want to, your voice sounds like it's getting a little hard. Do you want to take a,
let's
four,
take a quick break?
Four and a half
minutes.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to play. Now this, I wrote this back when Katrina.
Was this the song that you sang?
Right. You might remember the original Arlo Guthrie, you know, City of New Orleans.
Oh, yeah.
I just used the same software that I use for the show to strip out the wavelengths of the male voice, and I rewrote the lyrics, and here it is. It's 4.5 minutes.
Oh, that's so cute.
Maryland down on the city of New Orleans, Category 5 and coming without fail. 3 days in hell, locked inside the Saints' Dome. This hurricane is way beyond the pale. All along her northbound Odyssey, she bulldozes the Florida, rolling over houses, farms, and fields, tossing ships that had no names, greatest a cadaver appointed, ain't no one keeping score. Pass the buck that holds the people's futures. It's a sin the winds are beating down the door. And the sons of fearsome pirates and the sons of old Hickory paid an awesome price for their granddaddy's greed. Mothers with their babes asleep suffer in oppressive heat, and the rhythm of their ways is all you feel. Goodbye.
Sorry about that. I guess I ran over. That flew by. Okay, everybody's mic is live, and we have a caller. Area code 928. What's your question?
Hello, this is Gary David.
Hi, Gary. Some of the voices on the air.
Mark and Kimberly, hello to you.
Hi.
Hello, Gary. Will Blueotter. How are you?
I'm doing. This is how I am.
Oh,
well, go ahead.
I was wondering if you had made your listeners aware of what's happening in the Grand Canyon.
Well, that's,
as
that's
we speak.
I was just about to.
Mark was telling me, I didn't expect to hear from you. It's a real pleasure. So yeah, go ahead.
Well, this just came about. Within the last couple hours, I found out about it. I'm usually the last person to find out about these things, but it's been brewing for quite some time. The Navajo are planning to build a luxury hotel, an aerial tramway, an amphitheater, and big roads right at the confluence of the Little Colorado and the main Colorado rivers.
Oh.
This is very close to the Sipaponi of the Hopi and the Zuni. And it's in sacred land.
Really?
And I was wondering
if you had
read anything about it. It's in the Arizona paper, the Arizona Republic, the Navajo Times.
I didn't know anything about it until Mark messaged me that you had mentioned something about it.
Yeah, I went out there with a party of about 8 or 10 just last week. Okay, and we filmed everything out there. We were right at the confluence of the Little Colorado and the main Colorado. And we saw helicopters swooping down into the Grand Canyon. They were diving into the Little Colorado River Gorge. They had suspended on the bottom of the helicopters, they had water pipes, it looked like, and they would dive into the gorge and then drop off the water pipe and then come back out without a water pipe, and then they would dive back in to the gorge, right past the Zipapu. And,
really?
Yeah, and there were about 5 pickup trucks across the canyon, and they were all marked the same. And there was a flatbed truck, a large semi-truck out there. When they saw that we were watching them and filming them, they started to dive below the rim of the canyon, so we couldn't see them. So they're already starting to do work on this project, which would completely destroy the Hopi sacred areas.
It's horrifying.
It was a shock to me. And, you know, this has been going on. I don't know where. I've been sleeping for the last couple of months, apparently. But this has been brewing since March.
Really?
I've been in a few of the newspapers. And I just, you know, just by chance, I went to the Navajo Times and just to take a look and see what's going on in Indian country. And, you know, there it was, you know, articles and links all over the place. And there's a Save the Confluence group. One of the chapters on the Navajo Reservation has already voted against it. Apparently, the Hopi have voted against it, too.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
And the National Park Service has voted against it, but they're already starting to do work out there.
Whoa.
So, you know, and this is very disturbing. We were with a Zuni elder named Clifford Mahudi, and he wanted to do some prayers and blessings as close to the Zipapu on the rim as we can get. And he refused to do the ceremonies when he saw these helicopters.
Isn't that the elder you know Clifford, Kimberly?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what I wrote that last posting was.
Yeah.
As I was just going to talk about the Lost City after I rested my voice, and then I wanted to talk about the Zuni Rock also, because, so why don't I tell you about the Lost City of the Grand Canyon, because that's also a friend of Gary's and mine, is this guy Jack, and then I can tell you about the Zuni Rock, because... it's kind of...
But you're welcome to hang around or whatever you want to do. I would like to get you on for a full show
sometime. Sure, yeah. I think, we'll get back together as soon as... I'm sure of my cell phone connection, so...
Oh, no problem.
...out at any time, so...
Well,
poor reception there.
Is this the city under the mesa that was discovered by... back in 1908 and hushed up.
Yeah, this is it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is the story.
I've got pictures of that magazine article at the NativeAmericanProphecy.com.
Well, here's the story. In this last, 10 years, when all this amazingness has been happening, I've been meeting all these wonderful people, and I think I met Jack through Gary. To be honest, I don't actually remember, because it just seems like we're this, like, family, you know, like now, like Blue Water, you're part of the family, because I've had dreams for many, many years that say it is time to gather the others. Well, I hadn't seen the articles, but I have dreamed about meeting with Grandfather Martin at the bottom of the Grand Canyon all my life, like just about everything. Like, he even told me to name my older son Lakota, which I did, and, you know, just all these things. Well, so it turns out that Grandfather Martin and Venerable Makatuka Rinpoche, I have been told, are the twin brothers of the Hopi prophecy. And if you look at pictures of them, they look identical. They have met each other, and they both, you know, believe this. I mean, I've talked to them, and they both believe that they are the twin brothers. Well, so anyway, so this there is supposedly this lost city of the dead under the Grand Canyon, this, like, cave that in 1909, G.E. Kincaid was asked by the Smithsonian to, you know, go explore this, and he did. And he found these amazing things. He found, you know, all kinds of artifacts and mummies and all kinds of whatever. But one of the things he found that did not make any sense to people was he found a statue of a Buddha. And this man, Jack, he's so kind and wonderful, he has sort of taken up the cause since G.E. Kincaid has passed. Because supposedly, you know, the government came in and took all the stuff and hid it and whatever. And so this wonderful man, Jack Anders, has, you know, sort of taken up the cause of protecting this place and writing about it. Jack told me, he said, there is a legend that there is a woman of mixed heritage, you know, white and native, who is somehow connected to the Hopi prophecy that can explain how the Buddha statue got there, what it's doing there. And he said, you know, Kimberly, I think that's you. Can you explain this? And I said, this is so wild. I didn't know about this, like, article or this person. But, yes, I've
Robert
been there
Ghost
in the meantime.
Robert Ghostwolf told me in one interview that he had taken what looked like Egyptian artifacts and physically shown them to Zahi Hawass, who
uh-huh.
swore up and down they were Egyptian. He says, no, Zahi, they're from the American Southwest.
Oh, that's so funny. That's so funny.
Yeah.
Well, I was told that this Buddha statue in the cave is a statue of Arikana. Well, Bhagatuka Rinpoche is the reincarnation of Varakana. Varakana was one of the 25 disciples of Padmasambhava, the second Buddha, who said, when the iron eagle flies. I have been told that the reason the Buddha statue was there was when the causes and conditions arose, then it would show that it was time for the Hopi and Tibetan prophecy to come to pass. And that as to how it got there, I was told that, you know, the Anasazi, because I know that's what you call it, Hisosanam, I forget what they call it now, but and the Tibetans, they can A-port and D-port things. And that at the bottom of all of these statues, they have a double Dorje, and it says, Om Mani Padme Hum. And so what was so amazing is, you know, that I did know how the Buddha statue got there, why it was there, what was the purpose. It was part of, you know, this Hopi Tibet prophecy. The thing that's so interesting about Clifford Mahudi and this Zuni rock is there isn't any hardly proof left about what was in that cave, because it was 100 years ago, and just like in that movie Raiders of the Lost Ark, stuff was all taken by the government and hidden away somewhere. Well, this man, Clifford Mahudi, the Zuni elder, contacted me, how did it work, after I did that Coast to Coast show, and said that he had a rock with ancient writing. And anyway, I think Gary sent me a picture of it, and I brought it to my Tibetan friends, and they said, yes, this is written in Tibetan. And they were able to transcribe it, and it's a beautiful rock. In fact, that latest posting, I think it's the March 31st, 2012, and it shows a picture, and it shows the explanation, and each one of the lines is a mantra from the various deities of Tibetan Buddhism. So the reason I find this rock so amazing is it's sort of the first proof that, you know, the Tibetans were here somehow, because I showed this picture of this rock to one of the lamas that I study with, and I said, you know, is this Bhakatuku's rock, because he has this stupa in Zuni, and he said, no, this rock's older. So to me, it's an amazing, you know, proof, because there are all of these other connections that connect the Hopi and the Tibetans. Like, I don't know if you know, but you probably know that, when it's daylight in Hopi, it's nighttime in Tibet. Like, if you were, like, draw a line right through the globe, you know, it's, like, the opposite from each other. And then even their language, like, the word Dawa means sun in Hopi, but it means moon in Tibetan. And the word Nima means moon in Tibetan, but sun in... Wait, moon and Hopi in Tibet. That's right. So it's so interesting because when it's sunlight here, it's moon there. I mean, it's just they have so many similarities. Another one is the sacred sand mandala that, you know, the Hopi and the Navajo make these sand paintings and the Tibetans make these, you know, Tibetan sand mandalas. So there's all of these, you know, similarities in cultures. The main thing is that they both, their core belief is that compassion, because, you know, the Tibetans, that's the whole thing, is about compassion. And then the Hopi, that is who they, you know, are. I mean, they were called the people of the small blue corn because when Massau, the creator, is handing out all of the, you know, corn and giving names and whatever, they took the last. They took a little piece of small blue corn because they were humble and kind people. They took the area that nobody wanted, these cliffs that had no water, because they wanted to be able to stay close to their creator. So
you want to hear a Thomas Bunyakia story?
Yeah, please.
Zula Brinkerhoff, who was one of my first teachers, also, you know, red-haired Cherokee.
Mm-hmm.
She was the personal secretary of Governor Bangor of Utah back in the 60s. And anyway, she was an official spokesman for the traditional Hopi for quite a while, wrote a book called God's Chosen People in America.
What's her name? I'll write her name down.
Zula Brinkerhoff, H-O-F-F. Anyway, the elders used to visit her all the time in Salt Lake, and she was talking with Thomas on the phone, and it said something about, you know, he needed a... She was at, you know, is there anything you need while you're here? Oh, yeah, well, I could use a peach tree. Oh, no problem, you know. And, you know, as soon as they got him up to Salt Lake, she took him over to this nursery. And, hey, have anyone you want? She was looking off. You know which one he wanted? He wanted the scrawniest, tiniest little tree you could find.
Yes. Well, because that's their whole thing. I mean, from what I've been told, the Hopi are the only tribe that have not succumbed to gambling. They're the only tribe that never made treaties with the United States, which is, you know, amazing, since from what I've been told, the United States never actually kept even one treaty. I don't know if that's true, but that's, you know, that's the story I've been told. And so they're truly amazing people. Something else I wanted to make sure I share before we run out of time, like I say, because the whole point of this Hopi Tibet prophecy is this time of never-ending peace.
And by the way, did you know Thomas spent the World War II in prison because he refused to fight?
I think I did know that. One of the elders I studied with was, like I say, is a woman. She was like, mm-hmm, the first woman who apprenticed with him for like 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard amazing stories, you know, about, yeah, because I think Hopi are not allowed to carry arms. Yeah, I mean, I was totally told that.
Well, that's a tradition, but you know, when that early in the Iraq War, when that column of you remember that girl that came home? She was a big hero from West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the people that was killed was a Hopi girl.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, they're totally, yeah, and it's the BIA dominated Hopi Council that's raising hell about people talking about the Hopi prophecy. They're not, you know, they're Hopi in name only. They're Hinos.
I'm not even going to touch that one. So let me tell you about this other amazing thing.
If they know you're there to visit an elder, you're liable to get followed by the Hopi Rangers. But go ahead.
Oh, I know. Believe me, I know all this. I've lived this. I know this. Well, I was going to tell you an amazing other story. Because, like I say, I was told that this all has to do with this stuff that's going on in 2012. They talk about access. When Grandfather Thomas made that, you know, movie, he didn't know how this was going to turn out. When I met Grandfather Martin back in, you know, 2002, he was not feeling real hopeful either. None of the signs looked like it was going to go toward the path of the One Heart. Well, in the last 10 years, because now it's 2012, you know, we've been out there and bringing the Tibetans and all kind of other changes, and all around the world, people are doing the sacred ceremonies, and, you know, people are doing what they came to do. you know, I've been told that behind the scenes, people have been asking Mother Earth for a second chance. Well, the amazing thing, and I write this on like three postings ago, when I went to see Grandfather last August, he asked me to write "Keep Going," that in the last 10 years, he has said, you know what, we have made it. This is all going to work. Don't give up. Because when he used to tell, you know, we go out there over and over and over, and he would tell the Hopi prophecy rock story. This is like before when, you know, he could hear better. Even now he still tells it. He can still talk. He just can't hear. You have to, like, write stuff down on a piece of paper. He used to tell this kind of bleak story about, you know, awfulness. But now he tells how that something has shifted. That he went out there one time, and it was like magic. He saw this line go over. I think Gary was out there with us when that happened. Me and my son back to the hotel, and I heard that, you know, it went on and on and on. He was talking, and he was saying, keep going. So it's a wonderful thing that there has been a shift, and it's showing up all over the place. There's another wonderful story I make sure I tell about, because, you know, the Hopi talk about the fifth world, and, you know, the Hopi, you know, people that I've studied with tell me, yes, wonderfulness is... it's happening. Well, the same thing's happening parallel with Tibet, and that the Tibetans talk about Shambhala, and they talk about, you know, trying to find Shambhala and Shangri-La, and everyone's looking for it. Well, the Tibetans have this, you know, legend that says if the causes and conditions arise, it will be revealed. But the vibration on Earth has to shift to a place where it can be found. It's there. We just have to cut to a place where we can find it. Well, the amazing thing, Blue Water, is just like in 1909 when this guy, G.E. Kincaid, found this cave, about 10 years ago, an expedition explorer named Ian Baker found Shambhala. And he's written this amazing book called In the Heart of the World, where he was commissioned by the National Geographic to find this place, that there had been legends, you know, and people for 100 years have been looking for it.
Heard about
and,
it.
And, pardon me?
Have you heard about it?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Bottom of a real deep gorge.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, in Pemaco. Because he has come through Santa Barbara. One day, Ian Baker approached Bakatuka Rinpoche, this is Rinpoche I'm talking about, and he said, you know, I am about to give up. I've spent either 8 years in 10 tries or 10 years in 8 tries, I can't remember, and with leeches crawling on me and giving up. And he said, is there anything you can do to help me? And he said, Bakatuka just laughed and said, you know, would you like a map? And it was so funny because with this map he was able to find, you know, Pemaco, the hidden land that some of us spoke of. But it really was that the causes and conditions had to be met for him to be able to get to the place he'd been asking for this map. And so something is occurring, and Venerable Tuku Orjan Funsuk is with Bakatuka's nephew, is from this place, and he has come to Santa Barbara, and he's the Tibetan that my son is, you know, studying with. He has a satellite, you know, sangha here in Santa Barbara. And what they're doing is they're creating a temple there, which is actually his temple from his past life. He talks very openly about, you know, restoring this temple because now it is time the whole world can go there. And so it's my job to sort of share this, that even though, you know, there's all kinds of scary stuff all over the news, that this other thing is happening, and, you know, that this Hopi Tibet prophecy is coming to pass. The thing that I find so interesting is that the elders and the Rinpoches that I have been fortunate enough to study with, they all knew this was a potential, but they didn't have any attachment to how it turned out, because, like, when I spoke with Bakatuka Rinpoche about, you know, they found this statue of Arikana in the Grand Canyon, he just sort of laughed. Oh, they did find it. I mean, it's sort of like when he gave Ian Baker that map. So I really, really wanted to share that it's happening. As recently as 10 years ago, it didn't look like it was going to happen, but it is happening. And so, you know, supposedly starting next year, it can begin to turn around. It's going to take a while, but it can begin the time of never-ending peace. I'm thinking let's take a little voice break. Maybe you can play some music.
Sure, sure. You got a favorite artist or something? I probably got something. What would you like to hear?
Me? Oh,
yeah.
Well, I like Joni Mitchell. You know, I'm a girl. You got so, Joni Mitchell.
So something, let's see. I've got Burn On by Randy Newman, Cry, 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 Custard Die for Your Sins. I'll just pick something here.
Pick something that was nice.
Okay. Do you like Leonard Cohen?
Yeah, actually, you know, Joni Mitchell used to date Leonard Cohen. I read that in her biography.
Okay, here we go. Here's Leonard Cohen. Hallelujah.
Okay.
Now I've heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah.
Hallelujah. Hallelujah.
That was a nice song. I never heard that song.
Yeah,
it's quite a song.
Yeah, his voice sounds good. It sounds really good. There's something else I really wanted to share before we run out of time. It looks like we have about 20 minutes. Because
we can make it go over as long as you want.
Oh, no, no. I should rest my voice after that.
Sure. Well, there's nothing hard and fast about midnight, so, you know, whatever.
No, that's, I would like to stop it because I'll have some, like,
sure,
cocoa or soup and go rest my throat. But, well, in fact, I'll mention that since I'm talking about it. I was born mute. I'll say this for the radio show. Like, not like, oh, she didn't cry much, but I mean like I was born with a birth defect. Didn't make any sound. And back then, you know, 54 years ago, they couldn't, like, they didn't have microscopic tests, and so they didn't know if I'd ever get a voice. And so it's an interesting thing. They've asked me to, like, go on radio shows and whatever when I can barely talk for longer than an hour. My voice starts to wear out. But I also feel like that's why I was given this voice as a gift, because of, you know, I'm using it. I'm doing the very best I can to share this information, this message. But that's the thing I totally want to share before the time runs out, because people have asked me. Oh, and I also want to make really, really clear. When I say people have asked me, this is not my private practice. My private practice is completely separate. That is actually how I earn my living. I do not mix the two up. I have a, you know, marriage family therapy practice. We just do counseling. This stuff is, you know, this other world, and I do not charge for it. But the message that they really, really wanted me to get out there was when these lights came and they said, you know, that I was a scout and that there are other scouts out there and that, you know, if we're able to pull this off, we find each other, and that, you know, more and more scouts would begin trickling in if we gave them the message, yes, let's go for this. Part of what I've been told with this Hopi Tibet prophecy is the coming of these new children. And I know there's some controversy about, you know, whatever, but what I've been told is since we have, you know, pulled this off and created this compassion grid, that more and more and more of the incoming children, the souls that are coming in, are from this place, from this, you know, advanced civilization, the Pleiades or whatever. And so it has been our job to try and pull off not blowing up the planet. And these children, they started flooding in around the early 90s. So they are going to be literally coming of age as of 2012. So it's our job to sort of keep the planet from blowing itself up. And it's their job to see it through to this, you know, this next shift. And it's so exciting because, like, my older son, you know, he's, like, graduating in the class of 2012. And they are different. Like I say, I'm very blessed that my little, you know, younger child is just like Tulku. But my older child has got something else going on, too. So many of the new children, they're different. What I've been told is happening with the collapse of, you know, the governments and the banking system, is it supposed to collapse because it wasn't working. And these new children are going to help to create a whole different way of life. They are like these advanced souls in these little bodies. And, you know, I see it. I see it in the children, you know, that my kids play with or children I have that come in as patients or whatever. They are different. They know things. They're wise in a way that, you know, you see rarely. Now most of these new generation have come to sort of, you know, change the world. I mean, have you heard of this whole new children theory?
Talk about, like, the indigo children? Sure.
Oh, yeah, that's like one of them. They got a whole bunch of different ones, but I wanted to make sure that I mentioned that because people have asked me, what the hell's going to happen that's, you know, going to
happen? Have you ever heard of the pale one?
Yes, that's a Cherokee thing, isn't it, the pale one?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a cyclically
Tell me more about it. You tell me about that.
Just a cyclically reincarnated being, and he comes back, you know, to the Cherokee from time to time, and teaches. And he was called the Pale One because he had a light that shone out of his face. It may be a whole race of these children, because when my son was growing up and we were living on the mountaintop in a private tribal reservation, I couldn't talk to him in going into the OC, you know, sweat lodge, with me. But I talked to him and I said, "Well, if I don't go in, will you go in?" And he did. And when it was over, the fellow that was pouring water, Ron Stoneaxe Jones, came running to our cabin. And he says, "You won't believe what just happened." I said, "Yeah, I probably will." And he said they were praying, and they asked Joe to pray, and they said, you know how dark it is in the lodge, and they said when he prayed, his face lit up and hit up and lit up the whole lodge. So
how old is he now?
He's born in 80, maybe 27 in November.
Oh, that's amazing. I really do believe
he doesn't know who he is yet, though. It takes a while to grow in it. Until you're about 30, you really don't really even start this. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh no, I was gonna say, I had that experience with my younger son. I should mention this too. I have been told that what has saved the world from itself is that all around the planet, people have been doing the sacred ceremonies and rituals in the last 10 or so years. Well, I was fortunate enough in 2007 to be able to attend this first international Sundance. And it was an amazing thing because, the Lakota had to dance underground for 100 years because they could be arrested, whatever. And then in, I think it was 1978, Senator Daniel Inouye of Hawaii was able to pass the, I think it's called the Religious Freedom
Act. NARFA.
Native
American Religious Freedom Act.
Yes. And
he made it very easy. He just said all a person needs to do is to create an ID card in camera, which means in private. You know, so saying that you are a native religious practitioner.
Yeah. And so because of that, then the Lakota were able to dance their sun dances again. And then there was a prophecy that said, all the races would...
You know what you can do with that card also? You can collect herbs on any federally owned land.
Oh, I didn't know that, the backstory. But, no, that's wonderful. That's a great story. But anyway, so we were invited to go to this first international Sundance, and it was, in Lakota land. And it was the most amazing thing because we had this whole, got the Sundance tree and whatever, and all these different races, showed up wearing their different tribal, decor. I mean, it was just an amazing, amazing thing. And but what was so cute was my little boy was 10 at the time. And there's this wonderful man named Michael Tamura, and he's from Japan. And my son went with them to do the sweat lodge at 10. He was initiated into the sweat society. And I remember my oldest son and I went down to the RV where we were staying because I didn't want to stay at 10. And we came back in the morning, and I said, do you know where my boy is? Do you think the coyotes... stolen, and my friend Flo Yepo, who's Pueblo, said, "I think I saw the coyotes bringing him back." And it just, it sort of just captures that there is this new generation of children that they're very wise, and like I say in the case of my sons, they're extremely compassionate. So I believe that, what they have told me about we have entered the fifth world is true. I mean, I know that that's very controversial because only a Hopi can really, really say it, but I'm just saying that is what they told me to say. I mean, Grandfather Martin asked me very specifically, go tell the world that I was at Prophecy Rock and I saw a line go up around the back that wasn't there before. The line means keep going. I write that on one of my postings. He wanted the world to know that it was, you know, this alternate reality ending. It could have been one heart. It could have been two hearts. They didn't know. They were just kind of writing it out. But that he said very, very clearly, because people have showed up all over the world in different ways, we've pulled through. And I've been told by others that, you know, there are, I know it's something, of course, you know, wacky, that there are civilizations all over the universe that have been watching and observing, and that they're pleased. They're pleased that we've done this. I'm personally not entirely clear how it was that it failed on the other planets, but I just sort of have a sense of what they're talking about, and in dreams, more and more is being revealed to me, just how amazing what has happened on Earth in the last 10 years is, that it's really just nothing short of a miracle, because it could have been the end of everything, but instead it is potentially the beginning of a time like we've never experienced. So anyway, I know we just have a few more minutes, but did you have any questions or anything before?
No, go ahead. And by the way, I'm putting the picture of that that rock. Up on. I change my profile picture quite often, but if you go to my Facebook page, you'll see it along with the. And by the way, there are links to your websites and anything anybody wants, you know, right there on the interview blurb there.
That sounds good. Yeah, just tell them to look at www.thegroundcrew.com or Transforming Through 2012, because some people have contacted my therapy website, and I have to tell them, that's just therapy. I don't I'm not like a guru or anything like that. I'm just a therapist. All I do with this prophecy stuff is pass along what I've been told to pass along. I am not someone who, is out there leading ceremonies. There's plenty of people doing that. That isn't me. I'm just passing along this message. Like I said, I do not charge for it. I earn my living just being a regular therapist.
Well, so what you're saying is you don't want to be confused with a wannabe?
Listen to this for
1 minute.
The Red Road is hard to travel in these times, grandson.
Hey, brothers. You all heading to the All Nations?
Yeah.
Cool beans. Me too. What tribe?
We're Sioux. Pine Ridge, South Dakota.
Hey, all right. My great-grandmother's grandmother, well, her aunt, she was one-third Kiowa.
Ah, Kiowa. Strong nation.
Yeah. Hey, could I hitch a ride with you, brothers?
No. No room, man. I'm on a horse.
That's cool, man. Hey, maybe I'll catch you at the powwow.
Wannabe.
Maybe he's trying to be connected.
But they stole our land? Nothing more, our sweat lodge?
Their fathers stole our land. Long ago it was said the white man would look on in disbelief as his sons and daughter began to adopt the Indian way, to learn what their fathers didn't understand. Yeah. These are wannabe. We want to be connected.
And they started coming in the 1960s.
That's so good. Where's that from?
And that's from the motion picture Dreamkeepers. But they started coming out of the Bay Area to Metatonte. My teacher grandfather, Rolling Thunder's place. And the Hopi elders were right behind him on all of it. The Hopi and Rolling Thunder, they birthed this movement of the grandchildren of the yellow hair coming to the red man to learn wisdom.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that I was actually, I guess I had a couple minutes. There's a wonderful book by this Cherokee woman. Do you know the Venerable Johnny?
Johnny Oahu. Yes.
Yes, she's a Tibetan ordained
Sunray.
Lama.
Sunray.org.
And she's written. Pardon me.
Sunray.org.
Yes, exactly. Yes, and she wrote this book called Voices of Our Ancestors,
mm-hmm.
and she talks about that in 1969 there is this like meeting with the Cherokee where they decided if we're going to even have seven generations, you know, they talk about seven leaving seven generations in the future, that we're going to have to share our Cherokee wisdom with the white people, or they're going to like blow this place up.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that's what I was told, that that's kind of when all of this began to shift and the people began, you know, waking up, but that very, very, very much in the last 10 years, people have rallied all over, and that we really do have the internet, you know, to thank, because the people had it in their hearts, but they couldn't find each other that easily. But with this instrument, this internet, we can find each other, and like this radio show I'm doing, you know, it's the result of this internet where it creates the opportunity for people to rise to their highest self. I believe that really it's going to help us, you know, it's created a way to communicate. It's also created a world of transparency, which didn't exist before. Now people can just put something on their cell phone and have it up on YouTube in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's changed everything. Nobody can get away with stuff like they used to. It's
murder.
Been startling and jarring, but it has changed the world. I mean, some of it's really silly, but some of it is created, because like I say with my son's generation, this is the world they live in. You know, so they're being born into a world where, you know, whatever you're doing, you can't hide it like you could before. And so it's a world where they sort of have to live in integrity or be exposed. I mean,
there's a Bible prophecy that says in these times, things that were hidden up since the foundation of the world will be shouted from the rooftops.
Yeah.
And what's on,
it is like that.
What's on your rooftop? Your satellite dish.
Oh, yes, that's funny. That's very funny, yes. Yeah, and yes, that's there's actually even some satellite dishes out at Hopi. You know, they have like the different villages, and there are people that still live very, very, very traditionally, and then there's some that, you know, they got internet and cell phones and everything. It's quite amazing. Well, anyway, it's about 10, so I should go rest my voice. But it's been a pleasure talking to you and Mark and Gary, and plus, I didn't know you're Cherokee. It's been wonderful to hear so much about this. I want to read this. So you have this on your website so I can read more about this Cherokee stuff?
Oh, yeah. Just go to prophecykeepers.com. There's all kinds of links. And hey, Mark.
Yeah.
Do you think you could quickly do her or Mayan birthday?
Sure.
Oh, he's always working on that. He's always sending me these cool things, how my son and I are linked to this and that. I have no idea what he's talking about most of the time.
This will tell you how what makes you tick.
What was your birth again, Cameron?
My birthday is February 7, 1958.
February 7, 1958. So I'm going to do a couple of them here. So in a traditional Mayan day count, it's February 7, 1958, right?
Uh huh.
So in traditional Mayan day count, and so on the current Mayan calendar for our world cycle, that day was on a day called Nine Kuak. That would connect into the to the, a lot of the white buffaloes were born on that particular glyph.
Oh, neat.
So it's also considered as kind of a storm glyph, or the turtle sometimes associated with it too.
Huh.
And then let me pull up another one here and look up another thing on it. 19. This will give a little bit more information about the next world cycle. So it's showing things. We'll do three things here. Two time flows, a forward one, a backward one, and then the unity of them. On the So the forward one's going to be more from birth forward. Uh-huh. And this one's talking about dreaming, intuition, abundance, cooperation, family, things like that.
I'm all about the dreaming. I agree with that. I'm all about the dreaming. I agree with that. I love that.
Now, on the backward thing, this is stuff that's going to be coming in probably last few years, usually pinning around 1998 or after, or maybe even before that, but around that time as things get stronger. And it has to do, this is showing a lot of things that would be condor energy related to the prophecy eagle and condor, so it'd be the condor part. Which is the condor is considered kind of like heart, and the eagle is considered like mind. And so in this, though, the condor energy is going towards looking into things and exploring things, but no fear. A lot of things having to do with justice and reason, learning about...
Oh, I'm all about the justice, yes. That sounds good.
Just dimensionality and form and how to work with that. And then it's coming up with con energy, and that has to do, actually, with the Pleiades.
Oh, well,
the
there you go.
The con glyph itself looks like a seed going in the ground, and in Mayan thinking that would be obviously a corn seed, and the Hopi would sort of think the same thing. And Grandfather Martin was born on a con day. So that's showing that connection back to him with this... energy. And where the two come together, this is kind of like the doorway or the bridge between world cycles. And it's talking about it's an Etznab glyph, and it's talking about unification, universality of all, inclusive, loyalty, heart, good virtues, and things like that.
That's great. That's great. Thank you for doing that. I appreciate that.
Well, folks, this has been Prophecy Keepers Radio. Join us again tomorrow night, and we'll sign off with the rest of The Light by Rob Roberts.
Jasa Sagonige, a seventh great grandson of Samanuka, keeper of the Holy Cherokee Ark, who during the American Revolution became first beloved man of the Cherokee
headman of the Upper, Middle, and Lower Cherokee. Please join us at 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Sunday evenings and learn how you, regardless of ancestry, may gain the privilege of worshiping as you please, even using indigenous plant-based native sacraments. Aho. You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault.
Inside the rainbow, look inside the heart. like a lover's hand upon the heart, the very breath you gave me grows intently through the years and becomes lost dreams. So let the wind blow. Let the truth